And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where we are about to debut a regular episode series called So Where the Hell Were We? But before we do that, I want to welcome in the great Kevin Pelton, who's going to do this first episode with me. But before we get to that, we have to talk about the coronavirus and everything that is going on surrounding the NBA season. Mr. Pelton, how are you?
I'm doing as well as can reasonably be expected at this point, I think.
I think that's very similar to my stock answer of hanging in. Just hanging in. That's all I'm trying to do is hang in. So here are three things that have happened in the last, let's say, 10 days to increase the volume of noise around whether the NBA should even attempt to do this season restart in Atlanta. And maybe I'm missing a thing. If I'm missing a thing, please let me know that I'm missing a thing. Number one, the U.S. has recently set its record for most coronavirus cases in a day. I believe that happened yesterday, Wednesday, whatever day. The days are not important to me anymore. It's June, I think. And several areas that reopened too quickly, have shockingly experienced this spike in cases and a rebound in cases, including the areas surrounding, Orlando, Florida, which is home to several of all of the Disney employees who will be servicing hotel rooms and doing things like that. Number two, several players of moderate to high profile have already dropped out of Orlando, from Davis Bertans to a couple into Bojan Bogdanovic, who's injured, to Avery Bradley, to a couple other guys that I'm forgetting off the top of my head. And three, a number of players, have tested positive for the coronavirus upon reporting to their teams and reporting to their markets. And I can tell you for 100% fact, there are more players that have tested positive than have been reported or revealed. To some degree, that was expected. That's not surprising. In fact, that is somewhat evidence that a reminder that living in the larger world, the non-bubble world, exposes people to this virus just as much, if not more, of the as the bubble would be. And nonetheless, it is sort of just things are just piling up, and it feels a little rickety all of a sudden with all these things piling up. So I ask you, on June 25th in the afternoon, Eastern time, the morning in Seattle, where you are, where's your head right now? Is this something that should just be abandoned at this point? What's your take?
Well, you know, we've seen, I think, repeatedly on Twitter, the meme from Jurassic Park, your scientists were so busy figuring out whether they could, they didn't ask whether they should. And I'm growing increasingly skeptical, not really so much because of two or three. I mean, three to me actually is maybe an argument for the bubble, because it seems like an individual NBA player is going to be a lot less likely to contract the coronavirus within this bubble than they are just living their lives as they are conducting them now. I mean, we've seen this, and we've seen this with athletes in a variety of different sports, which is why it's not surprising. The NHL reported last week that of the 200 players they had tested as players were starting to return there, that 11 were positive. So, you know, over 5%. I mean, we're seeing these kind of huge numbers. And, you know, I think the NBA, no exception, to that. Now, the difference, of course, is number one, you know, even if an individual player is less likely to contract the virus in the bubble than they are outside it, they're much more likely to spread it, and they're much more likely to spread it to people who in day-to-day life, you know, coaches, team personnel, executives, things like that, people in day-to-day life probably are taking greater degree of precautions because of the fact that they are, you know, in a more vulnerable category, but because of the nature of the bubble, are going to inevitably be exposed if the virus begins to spread within it. So that's I think the concern. And then the point one, the first point you made specifically about the number of cases in Orange County, the Florida data dashboard has been the subject of much consternation. And, you know, the individual who created that eventually lost their job because of some concerns about the way the data was being reported. It is quite informative, in fact, and I navigated there today and looked at Orange County, and they've got a list. They show the graph of daily cases, and it shows that familiar upward exponential curve that we've seen, you know, throughout the world when this virus first begins spreading, because it is so transmissible. And right now, if you look at that rate, it's doubling every 5 or 6 days, and there's not really any indication of a reason to expect that curve to flatten, and especially to move downward and back in the direction where you'd want it to go. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I, ultimately, I think this, you've got to fall back on neither of us are experts in how viruses are transmitted. The vast majority of people on the internet are not. So fall back on the experts.
Really?
It may stun people to hear that, but initially epidemiologists seemed pretty positive about the NBA's plan. You know, we had Dr. Fauci calling it creative, but over time, as these cases have risen in Orange County, I think there is a greater degree of concern that even though the odds of, you know, that the NBA is going to do whatever is possible to minimize interactions between players and anyone who's not in this bubble, that, you know, even if that chance is really small, if you layer those small chances on top of each other with the number of, you know, whether it's, you know, housekeepers servicing rooms or things like that, that are going to happen if players are here over 3 months, that then it starts to become a concern.
Yeah, this is an enormously complex issue. It's not as black and white as some of the more angry people would like it to be. There obviously are financial aspects to this, and none of this is happening. The only reason this is happening is because of money. Let's just be frank about it. That's the only reason they're even attempting to do this, is to make money. And you can talk about how sports has healing power and, you know, all of this and all of these sort of intangible national benefits. Nobody would care about the healing power of sports within the NBA if they weren't standing to make like a bazillion dollars from this. The argument about whether how safe the bubble is very interesting, because I think the NBA would argue, and I think epidemiologists who still, I think, like this plan a lot would argue, for a lot of players and even a lot of coaches, the bubble will be safer from the coronavirus than regular society would be. And I think that's probably true. I don't know. But there are three confounding variables to that. Number one, there may be, and sports scientists expect there to be, increased risk of injury because of the long layoff ramping up into meaningful games right away. The second thing is, as good a job as the NBA has done in providing entertainment options and trying to make life comfortable for the players, there are potential mental health issues linked to being away from your family for 45 to 60 to whatever days and being isolated in a hotel room. So the virus is not the only sort of public health issue or player health issue that is involved in the bubble. And the third thing is, some players actually might be safer outside the bubble. That just depends on how you live your life and where you live your life. If you're in a place where the virus is under relative control and you are just ultra, ultra cautious and you're staying home all the time, then you'll be safer staying home, because basketball is a 5-on-5 full contact sport. And if one person gets it and there's a full contact practice and air particles and viral particles are flying through the air and you're breathing on each other and all that, that is, in an indoor space, that is a recipe for people to get the virus, pretty easily. So there's all of these variables that are wrapped up. I do think epidemiologists are still pretty positive about the NBA's plan. I think where I am now is that if you think the season should be canceled, I don't really have a huge issue with you. If you think the season should go on, I don't really have a huge issue with you. I mean, I don't think there's a great answer to this question. I'm still at the point where, because I think a majority of players want to go, and the experts keep telling me this is as sound a plan as could be crafted. Now, again, the surrounding area and the statistics in Orlando are poking little holes in that plan, but still, they're still saying that. I can't really blame the NBA for trying to go forward. I just can't. And I don't think it would be fair if this fails to go back and say, well, they never should have done it in the beginning. You have to say that now. You have to make that argument now. It's not fair to do that in hindsight, because then you're just using the result to make a judgment on their decision. And again, I think the NBA has telegraphed that they've let players, like, you don't have to go if you don't want to. And that's the NBA's way of sort of telegraphing that this is a really hard decision and a complex issue that should be left to every player individually. And then beneath all that, but connected to it, is the legitimacy of whatever champion might emerge from this process. Because That's linked to how many people get the virus. That's linked to how safe the bubble is and how impregnable it ends up being. Because I do think it's fair to worry about if there's an outbreak that just decimates a playoff series, that decimates one of the three or four best teams in the league. Are we going to look back at this as a dumb idea, as something that shouldn't have been tried? But I don't necessarily think it's fair to do that in hindsight. I just think this is a very complex issue, but I'm not at the point where I just am gung-ho that it should be canceled. I can't blame the NBA for trying. I can't blame them for going forward with it. It's a really, you know, other leagues are trying too, right?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, in the case of Major League Baseball, trying to do this without a bubble in team markets, which seems like it's going to be even more difficult to do because, you know, if we look at the issues that we have seen with teams that are currently practicing, preparing, the Orlando Pride, the Blue Jays and the Phillies in baseball, it seems to primarily be linked to, you know, players either picking up or, you know, even a group of players contracting the virus. Is they're living their lives outside of, you know, the sports space. Now they wouldn't necessarily be in those locations if it weren't for sports. So I think there is some blame to, you know, be cast in that regard, but the NBA has, you know, attempted to remove that. That's why you're doing a bubble. And the other thing I think that's going to be really important, to go back to players testing positive now is, that's okay because that's not the result of things they are doing within the NBA environment.
That's expected. The NBA was ready for this. The NBA knew X amount of players are going to test positive, and some teams have expressed, I don't know what the right word is. Like if our players are going to test positive, if that is your assumption that we cannot have zero players test positive, it's better from a competitive standpoint to do it, to have that happen now, that to have it happen in Orlando. Now that is a perhaps callous way of looking at a virus that, by the way, we don't know the long-term effects of it. We don't know the long-term effects of it for asymptomatic people, even people in their 20s who are supermen like these NBA players or super athletes. But that is a line of thought that is out there because just in regular life, X percentage of human beings are going to get this virus, and that X percentage is inclusive of professional athletes no matter where they are and what they do.
And probably more likely to include athletes because of the fact that, you know, number one, if they are trying to prepare by gathering to play basketball right now outside of NBA facilities, you don't have any idea. You don't have any controls in place to prevent spread there. So that's, I think, one of the reasons we're probably seeing. And then, you know, they're concentrated in metropolitan areas where spread has generally been higher, often in warm weather areas where now the spread is higher, even though it was lower back in March. And, you know, it's sort of the weather and the climate has changed in this country. But the factor that goes into it is now is the time we got to be really careful. These next 2 weeks here where players are at home in their team markets are not yet practicing. They're not going to be able to transmit it among each other. But if you do, you know, if there's a false negative, something like that, and you do bring it into Orlando with you, which, you know, they're reducing the chances of that by testing multiple times before you're allowed to actually begin practicing. But if you do bring it into Orlando, that's when it becomes a problem. So these next 2 weeks, it's crucial.
I guess I don't see, just in terms of virus-related health, I don't see the harm in trying. But as I said, there are other health variables, mental health, injury risk health, that factor into the health question of this at all. And even the legitimacy argument, like I think, again, the NBA has said to players, you don't have to go. And I think it doesn't really matter for the legitimacy of it if 20, 30, 40, 50 players don't go. What matters for the legitimacy of it is if those players start to be players on critical teams, and Avery Bradley was the first one. Lou Williams reportedly today was considering not going. That would be a huge blow to the Clippers. And they get it. And there's an outbreak within the bubble that just sabotages the whole playoff series. And by the way, everybody wants to know, what is the NBA's plan if 6 of the 10 best players on the Bucks get this virus at the same time? It's not addressed in the health guidelines. 113 pages of stuff. They address decks of cards and ping pong doubles, and they don't address that. They just say a small number of cases will not shut this down. The reason they don't address that, I would hazard to guess, is they don't want to put it in writing, and they may not have an answer to it. Because if you look at the calendar, Game 7 of the finals, should we get there, is October 13th. beginning of next season, should we get there, is somewhere in the ballpark of December 10th. That's already a tight offseason. That calendar has no wiggle room, none, for a, all right, you know what, stop the conference finals for 2 weeks while everybody recovers from this and quarantines. And by the way, isn't allowed to work out. The uncomfortable answer to the what if there's an outbreak question may be you only have two choices, and they're both unpleasant. Number one is you just keep going, and the Bucks try to win without any of their best players. And spoiler alert, they don't. Or number two, you just stop the whole enterprise and everybody goes home and it's regarded as a disastrous failure that is a stain on the NBA forever. And again, I don't necessarily think it would be fair to look from that outcome backward and judge this a failure. I don't really contest the idea that it might be worth trying, even now as the variables stack up. And by the way, part of this is dependent on, like, if we actually get to Orlando, and I keep telling people, I see these tweets, NBA is back, NBA is back. The NBA has never been back. And I've been consistent about that from the beginning. We are not back. We don't know if Orlando is happening still right now. The NBA, even the optimists have always said, whatever percentage chance that we don't get to Orlando is linked to, not even player willingness to go. It's linked to, is there a spike in the wrong place at the wrong time? Right now, yes. Is there another sports league that tries to congregate and discovers other disastrous factors that make this hard to do? We haven't quite got there yet, other than the ill-fated Novak Djokovic tennis tournament from hell. But we're not there yet, and we may not – who knows what will happen. But and part of it, if we do get there, what I was going to say is it will also be dependent on everybody there, not just the players, everybody, to stay in the bubble and not go out and come back and bring the virus in. And again, that's true to some extent in regular life, which is like we're all dependent on people to wear masks and take other appropriate – by the way, the mask thing, I guess I just don't understand. Have you seen these videos of people who are like legitimately outraged about wearing masks?
Yeah, and then also there was the thing that the – Department of Health mentioned yesterday, where people are printing out these cards that claim that they are exempt from mask requirements, which are fraudulent. So
even if you don't, let's just say you want to couch your mask argument in like the cloak of liberty, some vague liberty thing, and ignore all the other things that we do because we've decided that certain behaviors are bad for public health. You know, everyone wants to make the seatbelt analogy and all that. Like, how about you just wear a mask to be nice? Like, how about you just wear a mask to be a nice person that's trying to help society? Maybe, I guess you just don't believe that it's helpful because you've been brainwashed all, but that's what I can't understand about like the gung-ho anti-mask people is like, can't you just be nice? It's just a piece of cloth that you put over your face for a temporary period of time. And by the way, I just like to pretend it's Halloween when I go out in my mask. Like, I just like it just feels like Halloween. I just don't understand. That's just a whole different subject.
I mean, I do think like we focus so much on the exceptions that sometimes it gets ignored that the vast majority of people are wearing masks when they go out. And, you know, that's been a huge change within the last few months here. Like, it's incredible how quickly it has been widespread adopted once it became clear that that was the right thing to do.
My favorite guy is the guy, and favorite I use sarcastically, is the guy walking around with the mask in his hand or around his neck, even though he's not eating, not talking on the phone, not drinking water. Just like, so you've gone as far as to have the mask and have it on one of your body parts, but you've chosen not to put it over your mouth and nose. Like, what's that about? I don't get that.
That does defeat the purpose.
Okay, let's go into so where the hell were we? And I reserved for you my most interesting teams, or some of my most interesting teams. I excluded the Sixers from today's podcast because I'm just too interested in them. It'll take up a whole podcast. So I find this a useful exercise because I see on Twitter people saying, like, I forgot Reggie Jackson played for the Clippers. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is on the Mavericks, and I sympathize with those people because it's like that was a long freaking time ago that the NBA was happening, and it's useful to go back and look at how these teams were doing. So first team. So where the hell were we? Team one, the Los Angeles Lakers. Let's start with them because they just had a high profile player, a starter, bow out of Orlando. And that's Avery Bradley. The Lakers are 49-14, first in the West, plus 7.4 points per game. fourth in offense, third in defense. And then I looked at since the trade deadline as like a, as a proxy for sort of how were teams doing when we stopped. Since the trade deadline, they were 21st in offense, second in defense, 10-2 in their last 12 games, having just come off a big Bucks Clippers sweep. They had just acquired Markieff Morris, which is another thing that probably people forget. I know I did for a little while. The Markieff Morris era, sort of slipped by my long-term, medium-term memory. The Lakers by all looked like a team that was rolling, and now they've lost a starter. What's interesting to me about them is they have so many identities buried within their team. They have a super big team, a medium-sized team, a normal team, a team that plays Anthony Davis at center with Kuzma and LeBron, a team that plays Anthony Davis at center without Kuzma and a more traditional small ball lineup of three guards plus LeBron plus Anthony Davis. And it feels like some of those identities are relatively unexplored, even 63 games or whatever into the season. So start wherever you want with Avery Bradley or whatever. What is interesting to you about the Lakers as we maybe resume the season?
So I think what's most interesting to me about the Lakers is this is a team that we all expect will be there in the conference finals, perhaps the NBA finals, you know, if they can get through that matchup, which we're all hoping to see in the West between the Clippers and the Lakers, the two LA teams. But we don't know who the five players are who are going to be on the court when they finish games to a unique degree among the contending teams. If, you know, they've played 101 clutch minutes by NBA.com's definition this season, which is last 5 minutes of regulation or overtime game within 5 points. If you include JaVale McGee, who at 10 minutes is basically at 10% of that, they have 10 different players who have played at least 10% of their crunch minutes. That is wild in terms of just not knowing exactly who it's going to be. And there's basically been three defaults. LeBron has been on there aside from when his rest has happened to fall probably at like the start of that 5 minute period. He's been like 3 minutes he's been off the court. AD obviously is a given.
And by the way, before you go forward, like, we can overcomplicate these discussions a lot. Like, should they play with the center? Should they play with Kuzma? Should they play small? They've leaned toward playing with centers because they like the size and the defense and the rim protection. That's generally worked. However, a lot of the answer is if you have LeBron and Anthony Davis on the floor at the same time, you're pretty much awesome at NBA basketball.
Yeah, I went back and watched the fourth quarter of Lakers Clippers yesterday because that's a game I had watched with our buddy Seth Partnow in a bar in Boston at the end of the Sloan Conference.
What a bunch of nerds at the nerd at the Sloan Conference Coronavirus Fest 2020.
Yeah, so I hadn't like really drilled down on that game. And there was one play where, you know, LeBron just drives, draws three defenders, drops off to AD for a two-hand power dunk. And it's like, oh, that's a nice play to have in your back pocket in crunch time. So the third default guy, as I was starting to say there, has been Kentavious Caldwell-Pope of all people at 76%, the much maligned Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who takes on a larger role now with Bradley out.
Probably their likeliest fifth starter, I would say, although the internet will justifiably argue for Alex Caruso, who's been phenomenal. I think KCP probably walks into that starting spot.
Yeah, I mean, you can make a case because Caruso has been really good when he's played with LeBron. And if you want to get those two guys minutes together, keep KCP coming off the bench. I don't think it's a huge deal who actually starts. They've generally gone with, it seems like either Danny Green or Avery Bradley is the 3-and-D guy in those lineups. Together, they're playing about 84% of minutes. Sometimes they play together. We did see that briefly in that Lakers Clippers game where they threw out KCP, Danny Green, and Avery Bradley, which is obviously a thing they can't do now, but three guys who are very interchangeable role wing players alongside AD and LeBron. That actually was maybe my favorite of their lineup.
I'm glad you brought that up because I think I expected that exact lineup type. So three guards plus LeBron plus AD to be a bigger part of their team than it has been to this degree. And partly that I expected that because I did not expect JaVale and Dwight to give them this much. And that lineup type that you describe has been wildly effective in somewhat limited minutes. Their shot selection, so I looked this up on Ben Falk's like Cleaning the Glass. When they have LeBron and AD and three guards, their shot selection is as close to perfect as you can make an NBA team shot selection. They shoot like 16% of their shots are corner threes and like 40 something percent of their shots are at the rim. It's And if you just throw Kuzma in there, the shot selection kind of reverts to normal. And that's, again, what's so interesting about the Lakers to me is that they have all of these mini identities and none of them seem to have been explored all that much because the centers have been so good, or some of them haven't been explored all that much because the centers have been so good. But one, you know, there was a lot of snickering when Avery Bradley dropped out. Oh, I saw some people say, okay, this actually helps the Clippers title chances, or what the Lakers, or I'm sorry, hurts the Clippers title chances. The Lakers will be better, blah, blah. Avery Bradley's jumped into that Rondo territory where just everyone sort of loves to minimize his contributions. And I think he was pretty good for them this year. I thought he was a good fit for their team. Good on-ball defender, defending point guards, which is his best role on defense. He's much better at that than he is guarding wings, I think, because of his height, his lack of height and wingspan. 36% on threes, a good cutter. Their starting lineup with him is plus 13 per 100 possessions. The same lineup with KCP is just plus 3. But more than that, it just chips away at your margin for injury and or virus. Because if Alex Caruso catches the virus or gets injured, suddenly you're down to KCP and a bunch of dudes, maybe including J.R. Smith, who I'm not sure you want in a high stakes playoff game.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I went through and I've been doing projections using the multi-year version of our real plus minus stat, and their projection did actually go up slightly without Bradley. But I think in addition to what you said, there's also going to be, there might be one matchup where Avery Bradley just works perfectly in that matchup, and now you don't have that option. So, you know, it's traded off with the fact that maybe he was playing a little bit much relative to Danny Green than I would personally, but I'm like maybe the world's biggest Danny Green fan. So
I love Danny Green, but to your point, I think it's been proven over and over again to win four playoff series, at least in a normal season, you need almost everybody who's in your rotation, even your deep rotation. There's going to be, you know, a Corey Brewer game or a Peja Stojakovic game for the Mavericks, or a series where this guy who's your 10th man ends up being an important guy. It's just hard to win four playoff series. And I agree, on the very surface level, Avery Bradley is totally irreplaceable. More Danny Green, more KCP, more Caruso, done. But one of those guys gets injured or catches the virus and suddenly you miss Avery Bradley a lot, and you have less ability to play small without a center and without Kuzma, to play those lineups that I talked about earlier. Not saying those are their best lineups, but it's nice. It's a nice card to have in the deck.
We should also talk about, you mentioned Markieff Morris. Like, at least Markieff Morris played for the Lakers and played in those really important games that they won against the Bucks and the Clippers on national TV the weekend of Sloan. Dion Waiters never took the court for the Lakers. So it's even easier, I think, to forget that, oh yeah, they signed him way back in March, and all of a sudden, you know, he's going to be perhaps competing against J.R. Smith for those whatever extra minutes are created.
I can't even believe that's a sentence that is being said in June 2020. I mean, I can't believe anything that's happening in June 2020, but J.R. Smith competing with Dion Waiters. Remember, they were traded for each other, you know, 5 years ago or whenever that was. And everyone sort of laughed at that deal back then as like the sort of, it's like a internet Mad Libs, NBA Twitter Mad Libs trade. The bottom line is, I mean, Avery Bradley or no Avery Bradley, this team's really good and they have maybe the best playoff player, probably the best playoff player. And I hope we get to see them play. I mean, is there anything you didn't talk about? That any trend you saw in their recent play that was troubling to you? As I said, they were 21st in offense, but I just, given they have LeBron, AD, and their kind of shot selection they have, I don't really read all that much into that.
Yeah, that surprised me. I had not realized that that was the case. The one other thing I wanted to mention, just watching that fourth quarter again of Lakers Clippers, LeBron's defense when he dialed it up, like, there's a level to get to, and I'm excited to see whether he gets there on a regular basis in the playoffs, especially he's had these couple months now to rest in it. You know, he had the extended offseason last summer that seemed to benefit his play this year. Now these extended rest going into the playoffs, are we going to get a higher level of play from LeBron than even we expected? That would be very interesting to see.
The last thing I'll say on the Lakers, because it's a transition to the next team, is if you look at the shots they give up on defense, their third ranked defense is outperforming its opponent shot selection by a little bit. I'm not sure that's any troubling spot for this particular Lakers team, but there is some evidence that maybe they've been a little over their heads defensively, not so much. That brings me to my second team for where the hell were we? And that's the Denver Nuggets, 43-22, third in the West. For the season, they are 9th in offense and 12th in defense. Since the trade deadline, they are 6th in offense, and here's the blaring red flag, 23rd in defense. They allow a million corner threes and a decent number of shots at the rim, and that had started to come back to hurt them a little bit when the season slowed down. Mike Malone had a lot of angry press conferences in the last couple of weeks of that season. They had had really bad losses before we stopped to the Cavs and Warriors and gotten absolutely run off the floor by the or clippered off the floor by the Clippers. The Clippers don't run all that much, but just destroyed in LA by the Clippers. Nikola Jokic, A, got skinny, and B, got the coronavirus. And, you know, what was interesting about Denver before the season was everyone wondering if they run into Kawhi or if they run into LeBron, do they have a big wing in their arsenal that can guard those guys without harming their offense? And there was sort of general agreement, like, it's not Will Barton. It's not Gary Harris. Maybe it's Torrey Craig, although even though he had some big moments in the playoffs last season, particularly against Portland, not sure you want huge Torrey Craig rotation minutes. Maybe it could be Jeremy Grant in supersized lineups with Millsap and Jokic. We haven't seen that. And then out comes Michael Porter Jr., looking quite interesting. And playing most of his minutes alongside two of their big men is sort of a three, although he can be interchangeable. You can have him guard whoever is the least dangerous player on the other team and let Jeremy Grant guard threes if you want. I think that question is still unanswered. Mr. Pelton, what is interesting to you about the Denver Nuggets?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I mean, you remember back, this is going even farther back than March, to the start of the season, October, November, the Nuggets started slowly offensively. Jokic was clearly out of shape at that point before he got skinny. Before he got moderate and then he got skinny. It was a process.
Yeah, he had started to lose weight during the season. He started to look fine by the time the season stopped.
But the Nuggets won in October and November almost entirely on the strength of their defense. And it wasn't because the shot selection that opponents or the shot distribution that opponents was getting was any better. It was basically just that they were benefiting from opponents missing a lot of shots. They had, you know, Second Spectrum breaks it down to the expected shot quality, your QSQ, and then how well teams shoot relative to that expected shot quality, the QSI measure of shot making. They were number two in the league in October and November on that measure behind only the Raptors. And that's why they had the number one defensive rating in the league. But they have reverted to their overall shot profile since then. And opponent shot making since December 1st has been basically league average.
I like this team. I'm not sure I believe in them as a championship contender. Actually, I kind of don't, no matter what Jamal Murray says.
I don't know if I even like this team. I'm not sure there's anyone in the West that they could play in the first round that I would pick them over at this point. Maybe Utah, because they don't have Bogdanovich. I think that's the one.
Yeah, I think that Bogdanovich absence, they're not on our list of teams to talk to today, is a maybe not crippling, but a very big one for the Jazz. Yeah, I mean, look, it's the West, right? I mean, like, only the LA teams, I think, are immune to a first-round upset, and Dallas, who's on our list of teams to talk about today. Would it shock you if Dallas took one of the LA teams to seven games? Well, it shocked me a tiny bit, given Dwight Powell's injury, but not very much. It is interesting to me. I thought Jeremy Grant had a very nice season for the Nuggets this year, and it is interesting to me looking at some of those Porter power forward, whether it's Millsap or Grant, and center alignments. So one potential answer to who guards the big wings, right? Porter, Grant, Jokic, Porter, Millsap, Jokic. Those alignments with Jokic have not played all that much. They usually have played with Plumlee, and most of them have been bad. And the Nuggets have been very bad with Craig on the floor this year, like -5 per 100 possessions or something like that. So that issue to me is still unresolved, in part because I'm not sure Mike Malone is going to trust Michael Porter Jr. all that much in the playoffs. And but there's just not a lot of track record for any of those groups, which are all very interesting to me. On the other hand, their starting lineup is the most played lineup in the entire NBA for 700 something minutes. So they have a lot of continuity and a lot of chemistry with their main group. And Jokic is a stud. Just to me, they have a lot of the same questions that I had at the beginning of the season, I still have now.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, Jeremy Grant's had a really interesting season because he shot 40% on threes. He's done exactly, from an individual standpoint, I think, what the Nuggets hoped when they gave up that first round pick for him. And the Nuggets have been terrible with him on the court this season. They are 12.8 points per 100 possessions worse outside of garbage time when he's on the court, according to Cleaning the Glass.
Why do you have to refute my Jeremy Grant had a nice season argument with actual evidence? That's quite rude.
It's a weird season. I don't know what to make of it. The other thing I think we need to talk about with the Nuggets, though, is Gary Harris, because you talk about the last month. The thing that was going well for them is that Gary Harris was shooting over that period 58% on threes in the 10 games since the All-Star break.
Well, he was due. Either he had forgotten to shoot, or he was due, or some combination of both. So I had forgotten about that. That's quite encouraging, because I think Gary Harris has defensively had a great season and should be a good starting two. And this season, just his offense fell off a cliff. His shooting fell off a cliff. So it was refreshing to see him play well. Yeah, people looked at that Grant Millsap pairing as one potential answer to LeBron and Kawhi. Go super big, have Grant or Millsap guard the big wing of death that everyone fears. We just haven't seen a lot of that this season. And obviously they traded two rotation guys, or one and a half rotation guys, in Juancho Hernan Gomez and Malik Beasley, who's quite a good player. They just had too many guys and they got a draft pick for him. And so again, you need everybody. They may miss those depth pieces, but I like the chemistry of their starting five and the comfort that group has. And had this been a normal season, I would have been very interested to see what they would have done in the playoffs. Because I thought last year, you know, they won a playoff series against the Spurs in seven games. The Spurs team that wasn't very good. And then lost game seven at home to a Portland team. It was like, fine, that was a good team. To me, that was a sign of progress, but it was not a sign of like, this team is for sure a future contender on the come. And I wanted to see them in a normal season. This will not be a normal season. Any other Nuggets thoughts, or do you want to go on to team number three?
Well, you mentioned Porter, and you also mentioned that trade sending out Beasley and Hernan Gomez. And I think, you know, it wasn't the primary motivation for that trade. It might not even have been the secondary motivation, but a tertiary motivation somewhere in there.
Tertiary. Yeah. What's after tertiary? Quaternary?
I do not know that. Someone's going to have to tell us on Twitter. The tertiary motivation, I think, was, okay, if these guys are out of the way, Michael Malone's not going to have as many excuses to not play Michael Porter Jr., yes, who I think the front office would like to see play more than the coaching staff would right now, maybe not trusting him as much defensively. And that hasn't really happened. He's only been at 13 minutes per game since the All-Star break. It's basically, you know, the same as what he was playing before that, except for January when they had injuries and he played a lot.
I just like watching Jokic play. That's the bottom line. I miss watching Jokic play. My favorite guy to watch play in the whole league. Let's go east before we get to Dallas and go to where the hell were we? Part three, the Boston Celtics. Everyone's sexy dark horse to come out of the east, if not Milwaukee. 43-21, third in the east. A robust, I say robust, plus 6.2 points per game point differential, third in offense and fourth in defense, screaming championship contender. Although the defensive rankings are funny this year, where there's a huge gap from 1 to 2, and then, you know, everyone's kind of bunched up a little bit, but still third and fourth since the trade deadline, 18th in offense, eighth in defense. Kemba Walker had been injured in and out in the lineup, and now is healthy. Obviously, the biggest storyline of their last 30 games was the rise of Jason Tatum towards superstardom. That slowed down a little bit. But even when Jason Tatum toward the end of the, I guess should we just call it the end of the season, toward the end of the actual season, in games where he slumped a little bit from the field, I remained impressed with his ability to find other ways to contribute, whether it was getting to the line or getting 4 or 5 assists or playing really good defense. So I believe in the Jason Tatum superstar thing. This is everyone's pick. I mean, we talked about it on Get Up last week. We were posed the question, if not Milwaukee, then who? And two of the three of us picked Boston. I did not pick Boston, but this is the most popular sleeper pick. Do you believe that the Celtics are that good?
I would also, I assume you took the Raptors there. I would also take the Raptors by a slight margin.
I did take the Raptors.
But I think it's close. And one of the interesting things is, you know, if this were a traditional season, the home court advantage might be a huge swing in a matchup, 2-3 matchup like that. That's out of play now. So the fact that Toronto will likely have the better record through the seeding games, it affects who those teams will play in the first round, but it doesn't affect anything, assuming they get through and play each other in the conference semifinals.
Go ahead.
Yeah, let's talk about Tatum. I mean, I think the free throw rate is more encouraging to me than just the overall production we saw in February, because so much of that was driven by him making nearly 50% of his threes. Yeah,
the pull-up threes were like just getting ridiculous, like just absolutely preposterous. I mean, amazing to watch, but just like dude was just taking like four crossovers and jacking up threes over people and they were going in.
Yeah, I mean, he's a very good shooter. He's not that good of a shooter. I'm not sure that anyone is that good of a shooter. But during the month of February, when he was ramping up his usage rate because of the fact that Kemba Walker was mostly out of the lineup and because of the fact that he was just growing into a star who deserved that kind of share of the team's offense, if you look at the second spectrum metrics, his shot quality actually got a little easier. And that's not the way it's supposed to work. It's supposed to get harder when you take more shots. That's, you know, typically. And I think that reflects his growth along with the getting to the free throw line, which is something that's not going to be in shot quality, but is also going to make it easier for you to score efficiently, even when you're carrying a huge load offensively.
What's encouraging to me about the Celtics is that, although people have poked at their depth a little bit, like how much do you trust their key bench pieces, has been an ongoing storyline. And I think that's somewhat fair. I will say, I think Brad Wanamaker emerged as a huge plus off the bench by the time the season stopped. And, Robert Williams was back in the rotation the last four or five games. And I like the Williams back up front court of Grant Williams, who, if you just made a bench player in a lab for me, like to just enjoy, you would make Grant Williams just like a JV Draymond Green coming around, it up, playing great defense, making the right play. I love that guy. But if you just, I mean, they have essentially six starters, right? They're starting lineup plus Marcus Smart, heavy on ball handling, heavy on wings. If you just look at their lineups, when two plus of those six guys are on the floor, Tice is obviously the center. When two or three or more of those guys are on the floor, which is AKA the lineups you're probably going to ride when it matters, they're just consistently good. Like you can play around with any lineup construction you want. Tatum on, Walker off, Walker on, Smart on, Tatum off. Like those lineups are all really, really good. Which is, despite the fact that they have still have kind of like a lot of cooks in the kitchen thing, a lot of guys who need and want the ball, like their core construction works. And I think Jason Tatum's ascent even makes the core construction make more sense because now there's a guy. There is no argument anymore. Jaylen Brown is going to, I hate to say go into the Pippen role because Pippen, like, you don't want to compare people to Pippen and you sure as hell don't want to compare anyone to Jordan on the other end of that comparison. But he, I think, is going to go into that slasher, secondary attacker, lead the break, just find 20 points a game without searching out 20 points a game kind of player. Their team just makes a lot of sense and it appears to really work.
Yeah, to go back to those RPM projections I mentioned earlier, you know, I think Raptors fans, the case they would make is, look, we were the second best team in the East, despite the fact that there were major injuries over the course of the season.
Everyone. Yeah.
So this is going to be an even stronger team now that we're healthy going into this restart. But they don't benefit as much in those projections as Boston does just from tightening the rotation, you know, in as you mentioned, and sort of going to those core lineups. So Toronto is still ahead, but it's a closer gap than it would be based on the regular season results thus far. So that I thought was interesting. I mean, ultimately the biggest question for the Celtics is what kind of Kemba Walker are we getting after this 3-month layoff? Cause he was obviously not only out of the lineup, but sputtering when he was in the lineup. There were a lot of 5 of 17 shooting performances on his game log over the 8 games he did play in February and March.
Yeah, and I believe both of us were at the games against the Jazz and the Thunder right before they shut down. Two discouraging home losses for the Celtics. Am I remembering that right? They lost to the Thunder for sure.
Yeah, they lost to the Jazz too. That was the only one I was at. I was at the airport by the time of the Oklahoma City game.
That was a great game. That was just like classic Chris Paul irritant stuff down the stretch of that game. Stealing rebounds from on free throws, just doing Chris Paul things. What's interesting, so here's an interesting number. The Bucks have gotten a lot of attention, justifiably so, for crafting a defense that protects the rim at all costs, minimizes fouling at all costs, and to do that sort of sacrifices the three-point arc to some degree. They allow a ton of threes. Now, I think they have been smart about who they let shoot those threes. I don't think they're blindly allowing threes. I think they're allowing some. You and I may disagree on the sort of on the degree to which this is possible, but I do think it is possible to coax your opponent three-point spectrum a little bit towards the certain kinds of player, at least away from players that are very dangerous shooting threes, away from those players. And they've got a lot
in the spots where they're most dangerous shooting.
Right. An above the break three from a semi tentative pick and pop big, who's even if he shoots 37%, the Bucks are willing to live with that. What's interesting to me is, so Milwaukee is 28th in percentage of opponent shots that have been threes. Normally, like 2 years ago, that would have been considered a bad thing. You're allowing too many threes. They're number one in defense. Toronto is number two in defense. They're 29th, actually tied for 30th. In the percentage of opponent shots that are threes. Boston is 24th in the percentage of opponent shots that are threes. They're third in defense or fourth in defense, whatever I said. So that's three of the top four defenses are in the bottom six in percentage of opponent shots that are threes. Boston, almost during the entirety of Brad Stevens' tenure, has confounded statistical analysis by allowing a less accurate shooting percentage from three than expected every season, basically, and they're doing it again this season. So I ask you, as someone who knows the numbers way better than me and who has studied this in more depth than I am, is it interesting to you that Milwaukee, Toronto, and Boston, arguably the three best defenses in the league, are allowing a shit ton of three-pointers?
Yes, although maybe I don't want to say too much in case this is a topic we write about down the line, but it's something that has only occurred within the last two seasons since Milwaukee's rise last year. If you look at it historically, in the early days of the three, it was good to allow more three-pointers because of the fact that that was just a desperation shot. You were probably leading, things like that. Then there was a long period of time where the better defenses tended to allow fewer threes, and that reached its highest point probably 3 or 4 years ago. And then all of a sudden, just with no warning, it completely flipped last season, where the last 2 years, it has been better defensively for you if you allow more threes.
The Tibbs era Bulls, I think, were the poster team for just not allow it. Like, just you don't get corner threes against us, period. Stan Van Gundy's teams were built like that as well. And so I didn't know you were working on a piece about this. I'm sorry to make you talk about it. I'm glad, you know, that makes me feel like I was hitting on something interesting. I have no choice now but to believe that Boston has figured something out about opponent three-point shooting. It might not be, I might be giving them a little bit more credit than you might. But I just think it's too many years now where they are allowing a very low three-point shooting percentage. It's just too many years for me to dismiss it out of hand, no matter how many times you and Seth Partnow tell me to dismiss it out of hand as blind luck and something that they can't control. I kind of believe it now.
I'm trying to figure out who coined the term Jedi three-point defense. That's a thing, right? Oh, Hollinger that coined that.
Well, Jedi free throw defense is the classic one where teams that allow, like, you know, opponents are only shooting 69% at the line. We must be doing something right.
But it goes back beyond, you said the entire Brad Stevens era. This goes back to when Doc was there. And Doc does have some, his Clippers teams have had some tendency for opponents to underperform their 3-point percentage, but it's not as consistent as it was in Boston. So I can only assume that it involves the Leprechaun.
That's it. It could just be opponents are unnerved by the fact that the Celtics are the only team with a mascot that is a human, like a human, just a guy dressed up in a Leprechaun outfit. I don't think that counts as a mascot. And it would frankly unnerve me if I were an opposing player. It's interesting. You also would pick, I mean, I wish we could have gotten, you know, we've been waiting years for this Toronto-Boston series through different iterations of these teams, Isaiah Thomas to Kyrie to now. We've never gotten it. We were set up to get a classic, like two great home courts, two of the best home courts in the league, two of the best crowds in the league. It would have been awesome to get it under normal circumstances. But it's interesting. I think Toronto is really, really good. And the analysis of their season sort of was like, oh, they're – interesting. They're a happy story without Kawhi. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, feel good story. Nick Nurse is trying crazy stuff. That's cool. Look at Nick Nurse. He makes funny faces on the sidelines. Then they got hurt. Like a lot of guys got hurt off and on, you know, and then Siakam slowed down and kind of they just kept winning. And I don't think enough people ended up in the place where they should have ended up, which is this is just a really damn good team. They fit well together. They have seven or eight just legitimately really good NBA players. You know, Serge Ibaka has settled into the perfect role for himself. Norm Powell had a crazy year. I think the Raptors are really good, and I would pick them by a hair over Boston as the team most likely to get out of the East if it's not Milwaukee. Milwaukee is still the overwhelming favorite, I think, to get out of the East. Anyway, Toronto's not on our list today. Sorry, Raptors fans. Again, more evidence of anti-Canada bias. Let's do the last team on my list for today. So where the hell were we? The Dallas Mavericks, 40-27, but a plus 6 point differential, which is, I'm going to look it up now in the West, which is third in the West behind only the LA teams, and yet they are in seventh. First in offense by a mile for the season, 17th in defense since the trade deadline, fourth in offense, seventh in defense. People may have forgotten, but Dwight Powell tore his Achilles, a very big loss for their team. He and Luka Doncic were one of the premier pick and roll combinations in the entire league. I think the most interesting place to start with them is, how do you see them? They just signed Trey Burke as we're doing this podcast. Willie Cauley-Stein has announced he's not going to Orlando as we're doing this podcast. How do you see them, continuing to evolve without their starting center, who was a huge part of how they played offense?
Yeah, so the big thing that happened is, you know, they shifted primarily to these ports. We had talked about potential replacements for Powell. Cauley-Stein was somebody who made a lot of sense, it seemed like, is, you know, he can be a dive man in the pick and roll on offense, protect the rim on defense, and then he barely played after he got there. And they basically shifted almost exclusively to playing Kristaps Porzingis at center, and they were really, really good with Porzingis at center. Their net rating since Dwight Powell's injury, 15.5 points per 100 possessions better with Porzingis on the court. So the question for me is how they fill those minutes without Porzingis, which has been some Boban Marjanovic, which, you know, is a very matchup dependent play come the postseason. A lot of Maxi Kleba, and those lineups have not been as strong defensively. In part, I think, because of the fact that, well, if Porzingis is at center, you might have Maxi Kleba next to him to have two rim protectors on the court. If Kleba slides to center, there's nobody else who can protect the rim because they're much smaller in terms of their 3-4s, which, I think, did you mention Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is one of the people that—
I did. He's on the Mavericks.
And didn't play at all. He's someone I think who could benefit from the fact that you're going to have a training camp now as opposed to just being thrown in there on the fly as a buyout pickup after he was waived by Charlotte. So,
well, one of the benefits of playing Porzingis at center is he can do a little bit of everything. In fact, he prefers, I think, to pop out and space the floor rather than roll hard to the rim, which if you're Dwight Powell is heaven because you just dive and dunk all night long. And I think the Hornets by the end were like, well, really the only thing Michael Kidd-Gilchrist can do on offense is screen and dive. And so I don't think he's going to be a part of their playoff rotation. I would bet against it, but there is at least a role that's there for him. Here are some interesting numbers for you. First of all, Doncic and Porzingis for the season, okay, together and without any of their centers and Maxi Kleba. So Maxi Kleba's on the bench too. They're plus like 12 or 13 per 100 possessions, killing it. Here's the interesting one. First 15 or 20 games, the Porzingis without Doncic lineups were really bad. And then they crested, and for the season, they're plus 11 per 100 possessions with Porzingis and not Doncic. So again, another one of these teams that every kind of lineup type that they've tried is interesting. And you just hit it on the head. Kleba to me is the interesting piece. The one, do you start him as sort of he and Kristaps kind of share center duty or two traditional big men, or do you go all in on Porzingis at center with Doncic and three perimeter players? Those lineups have been dynamite all season. And between Tim Hardaway Jr., Seth Curry, DeLon Wright, Dorian Finney-Smith, throw in occasional Justin Jackson cameos, like the Mavs have decent perimeter talent. I mean, I don't think, you know, those are all like fifth starter types to me, but like they have a lot of fifth starter types. And that's kind of a powerful combination when you have one super duper star and another really good player who has good chemistry with your super duper star.
Yeah, I think that was a question people had about the Mavericks coming into the season, besides for Porzingis' health, because we just hadn't seen him that long, is, look, we like their top two guys, and I don't know that anyone expected Luka to get quite to this MVP caliber level in year number two, but, you know, who's their third best player? And maybe that's Kleba. We could probably do a whole podcast trying to figure out who the Mavericks' third best player is, but it's clearly not someone who's nearly as good as the third best player on most contending teams, at least ones that aren't really top heavy contending teams, but they've had just so many quality role players that they've overcome it. And so I would say that overall, I think the Mavericks probably benefit more from the conditions of this restart than anyone because, you know, as you said, they were seventh. They've got a chance to move up. They move up in a good percentage of the simulations of the rest of the season.
That surprised me when you did that because I thought they were too far behind really to get out. I mean, where are they? Let me look up. They're like three or four games out of – they're three games in the loss column out of sixth. But I was surprised how often in eight games they improved the seed.
Yeah, I guess the logic there being, you know, versus any one team, or it's going to be hard to make up those three games, but you've got – four different teams that you potentially can make it up against. So if any one of those teams goes on a slide, the Mavericks have a chance to move up. And then if they can get up into six and stay away from the Clippers in the first round, or if the Clippers somehow fall to third, which is less likely, then, you know, you get to that point differential third in the West, you don't have the home court disadvantage. I think I would probably take them in that series against a lot of opponents because, you know, they've got some interesting matchup possibilities depending on what kind of opponent you're facing.
Yeah, without Bogdanovich, I think they're just as good as Utah. And Houston, Oklahoma City, Denver, like Houston we're not going to talk about in this podcast. I've talked about them a lot. They had just sort of gone all in on super-duper small ball. Like I don't think any of those teams are like demonstrably better than Dallas. I understand if people don't want to believe in Dallas as quite ready to be a strong second round playoff team, having come off several lottery seasons and their cornerstone players are quite young. That's fair. Like the NBA typically is unkind to young teams. Luka Doncic is not a typical young player. And this team, also, what I like about them is they're very comfortable in their identity. They know how they want to play. They shoot more threes than anyone but Houston. They play a slow half court style. I think they're like toward the bottom in pace. They don't turn the ball over. Part of the reason they don't turn the ball over is they never get to the rim. They're 29th in shots at the rim, but they are, I'm not sure that's calculated, but they get to the line a decent amount given how rarely they get to the rim, and they don't turn the ball over a lot and they shoot a lot of threes. So in some degrees, not getting to the rim is kind of baked into the way they play. They don't run and they get back on defense. Their transition defense is pretty good. They're just a comfortable, well-coached, low turnover, heavy three team with a top, I think this season, a top 5 to 6 player and a second player who by the end of the season had begun to look a little bit like the player the Knicks expected he might become before they traded him for what turned into not very much. I like this team. I liked them at the beginning of the year. I picked them to make the playoffs. I didn't think they would be this good, but I like their team. I think they're a really good team.
I think they're also going to be interesting to watch because they're one of the teams that probably will look the most different from where they were in March, you know, for this conversation because, you know, at that point, Jalen Brunson,
I forgot about Jalen Brunson, who was great for them.
Yeah, and so he underwent shoulder surgery. Courtney Lee was playing a lot for them after the trade deadline, which is a huge surprise. We thought that he was either going to get traded, like maybe he would be ballast if they had gone after Andre Iguodala from Memphis or a deal like that. He was still around, was playing a lot. Now he's got a calf injury. So those two guys are out. No Collie Stein. They're going to look substantially different. And it's interesting. We'll see. They still probably have the opportunity to waive Courtney Lee. But if they're using Trey Burke as the replacement for Collie Stein opting out of the restart, that implies to me that they're going to go really small in Orlando because, you know, now you've got fewer front court options and you've added another point guard on top of, you know, they've already got DeLon Wright. Seth Curry's not really a point guard. Luke is the point guard. And JJ Barea, who had played decently coming off Achilles surgery and is advanced in his 30s when he actually got a chance to play, was still not bad, but didn't play a lot.
No, he was the break in case. He was like the Rick Carlisle's cranky and we're down by 20 in the second quarter. Here comes JJ. Come in and just mess up the game, JJ. Born to be a Maverick, JJ Barea. Yeah, I mean, when you talk about super small, you're essentially talking about maybe Kleba is the backup center. Maxi Kleba is good. Like he's a good player. The numbers with Doncic, Kleba, and Porzingis all together are not as good as other alignments of the team. They're only like +3 or +4 points per 100 possessions, but still good. He's sort of a Kuzma-ish tweener player who doesn't fit a lot of traditional designations, but he's been, I think, a better player than Kuzma, frankly. And you know, he's just a good player, and it'd be interesting to see. I get Powell's a big loss. The North-South game that he brings to their offense is a dimension that always is an important part of what Rick Carlisle does. Kleba can mimic that a little bit, which is, I think, not a little bit, he's quite good at it, which is, I think, why in most games, I believe he was starting as sort of your rim runner, roller kind of player. So they could go that route and stay sort of big-ish. They're just, I like their team. They're a good team. I'm interested to see them play. Hopefully we do at some point.
Yeah.
Any other Mavericks points we missed?
Yeah, I think that was pretty much all I had.
So we hit Denver, Dallas, Boston, and the Lakers. I'm still looking for my next guest for the So Where the Hell Were We podcast series, but I may drag you on again to do this. It's always fun to talk ball with you, man. Are you everything okay out there in Seattle? Are you doing well?
You know, I'm healthy. Family is, so, you know, can't complain.
What should we be on the lookout next? I mean, you're writing every day. It's ridiculous how much you're writing, but what should we be on the lookout for? Anything you want to tease?
Well, we'll have some projections as soon as we have a schedule. Like I said, I've run it, but it's just a guess right now. You don't know for sure what the schedule is going to look like. And then Mike Schmitz and I are working on some rankings of young players currently in the league.
So yeah, you did your second, and you did a second round, potential second round steals today.
Yeah, this has been draft week on ESPN Plus. So Mike and Jonathan have been busy, and then we rolled out my draft projections for the first time.
And the draft is in sometime, October. It's at some period of time there will be a draft, presumably.
I got a text from someone in the league. It's like, you're running your draft projections 4 months early. What are we supposed to do with the next 4 months here?
That is a question for to be answered in the day. All right, Kevin Pelton, your work is always tremendous. It's great to see you. Thanks for coming on to the first edition of So Where the Hell Were We on the Low Post podcast. Be safe, my friend.
Thanks, you too.